ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts, Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director here at EAA. And across from me is...
I'm Chris Henry, the EAA Aviation Museum Manager here in Oshkosh.
And Chris, once again, we have a very interesting guest from a part of aviation that I don't think we have talked about in the however many years we've been doing this show. And kind of like our medevac pilot a few months ago, certainly somebody that you hopefully won't have to run into in while they're on a professional, while they're working professionally, but certainly has a lot of interesting stories.
Absolutely, we have from the United States Coast Guard retired Captain Tom Cooper, a helicopter pilot in Coast Guard Aviation. Sir, welcome. So honored to have you here.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the introduction and opportunity to be here, especially being the first Coast Guard aviator I think you've had. So super glad to just tell the Coast Guard story. And Coast Guard Aviation, I don't think maybe gets as well known as it should be. And I love the men and women of the Coast Guard in my 28-year career. And they just do a lot of really, really good things. And to your point, Tom, maybe on people's worst day is kind of when they show up. So
yeah. Well, so let's start just out of curiosity. Where are you from originally?
Originally from the Bronx in New York.
That's it. East Coast Mafia taking over the green dot here.
Nice. We were talking about that earlier, right, Chris? But from the Bronx originally, an Irish community there. So my mom is from Ireland. Three out of four grandparents born and raised in Ireland. So first generation to go to college, and I have a twin brother, Dave. And at the time we looked at service academies, our dad was an enlisted Marine and he said, hey, go Coast Guard and go to the Coast Guard Academy together. And that's what we did back in, I won't give the year, but a long time ago we went to Coast Guard together and we both end up being helicopter pilots and flying. Dave flew for 25 years. We call someone who flew for 25 years a quitter because I flew for 28 years. So.
That's wonderful. And so did you have any aviation interest or experience before the academy, or what made you decide to be a pilot?
You know, truthfully, I'd not too much. My dad had taken us up flying a couple of times in a seaplane. He had a friend who was a pilot, and Zelda took us out, and we really enjoyed it. But when I got to the Coast Guard Academy, it's primarily a seagoing service, and everyone had at that time go to a ship for their first tour for 2 years. And so I went and did that. It was a buoy tender in New York Harbor, and I really enjoyed that mission and being on the buoy tender. But I had friends who had gone to flight school. We go through the same flight school in Pensacola that the Navy and Marine Corps do. And they were telling me about how much fun they were having flying and being down in flight school. So I applied through an internal board to the Coast Guard, got selected, and went down to flight school and kind of figured out that I had an aptitude for flying. I wasn't frankly sure if I would or not, but I think I did, and turned out to be a good pilot and really enjoyed it.
You know, that's really an interesting sort of mindset. Is, you know, you weren't like, yeah, I knew I wanted to fly and that was it, and I was awesome at it right away. You know, you tried something new, a little bit outside of your comfort zone, you know, to get there.
Very much so. And I give Pensacola a lot of credit because they take somebody like myself who's maybe never flown before, and they can take you and, you know, make you into a naval aviator. It's not built for people that already have prior flight experience to come in, though it does help if you do, right? But so, you know, anyone listening out there, if you want to be a naval aviator, you can do it. You can absolutely, they will train you and teach you how to do it.
What was the pipeline like at the time? Did you start fixed wing and then go?
I did. Start in the T-34. Did that first. You know, obviously, it's cheaper than helicopters, right? So it just makes sense to train you on a platform like that. And then went and flew, Navy helos for, you know, about 6 months. The whole flight school took me about 18 months to complete. I think these days it's taken a little bit longer than that, more like 2.5 years. But got it done in 17 months, I think. And then went to Coast Guard, our aviation training centers in Mobile, Alabama. So went there for about a seven-week course, learned how to fly the mighty H-65, the Dolphin helicopter, and that's what I flew for my whole career.
So I guess we should probably start there in terms of Coast Guard Aviation. Is kind of what is the mission of Coast Guard Aviation, and what's in your inventory, and what do they do?
Yeah, so we have about 200 aircraft total. About 140 of them are helicopters, 165s and about 40 60s. Fixed wing is like C-130s, a few others. Primarily the mission is a lot of homeland security, law enforcement, but primarily people probably know us mostly for search and rescue.
So what was your first, so I guess first off, did you just know right away you wanted helicopters, or did that kind of get figured out at flight school?
At the time, there was very few openings for fixed wing. So it just was going to be helicopters. And frankly, I didn't even care which one I flew, whether it was 60s or 65s. I was just really looking forward to getting out there and doing the mission.
So what was your first impression of the 65 when you know, first day you walk out there and you see it and it's an aircraft that you're going to go learn to fly?
It's a great looking aircraft. It's slick. The avionics in it, incredible. Actually, I think it was the first four-axis helicopter to be IFR certified for single pilot in the environment. So, you know, so it has an awful, like a really good avionics package to help you out, because we do a lot of flying at night, offshore, without really a visible horizon. So if you think about it, it's mostly IFR type flying. And I just really enjoyed the Dolphine. It's got a lot of sophistication to it that maybe some of the others don't have. It's a smaller helicopter. It's actually really more of like a commercial helicopter than you think, like a Herky DOD or even 860 that we have. But there's some advantages to that. It fits, on the back of our cutters a lot better than like a 60 would, though we can get 60s on some of our cutters nowadays. But back when I first started flying, it wouldn't have fit on several classes of our cutters, but the 65 does. So it's really more of our seagoing helicopter as well.
I was going to ask about the missions, the mission between the two helicopters. So yeah, we're talking about the Dauphine that you flew, and then for those of you who don't know, the 60 that we're talking about is the H-60, which is outwardly similar to a Black Hawk or a Seahawk. I think it's based on the Seahawk, right?
It is. Yep, the same.
So is it really just range? The 60s are more land based, that kind of thing.
The 60s have more endurance, more range, more power. The 65 is very power limited. So you learn to fly the collective, very, very small movements. Otherwise, you will over-torque. And as the saying goes in the 65 community, there's those that have over-torqued and those that will over-torque. So it's just a matter of time sometimes. So you have to be really careful when you fly that the 65, especially in the operating environments where we do, where you are right on the power edges an awful lot.
The one of the things I wanted to ask you about with the Dolphine was the type of engines you flew. Were you strictly on the versions that had like the later turbo mecha engines, or were you in the Lycoming stuff yet?
We're through five models now of the 65. The first couple, the Alpha and Bravo, had the older engines, Lycoming, Honeywell engines in it, and then with the Charlie model came the turbo mecha engines that, you know, we're kind of originally sold with the helicopter, but we didn't have them because when we got the acquisition, it had to be 51% American, is what I'm told. And so therefore, that's why we had the engines. But eventually, we did get the turbo mecha engines put into them.
Chris, it sounds like you have some familiarity from your medevac days.
Yeah, we had Dolphines out at Step Medevac for a while when I first started. We had the N2s, and we had the turbo mecha engines in them. They were awesome aircraft, really distinctive sound, and I think you said that sound may have changed now, but when we had the old N2s, they had a really distinct sound.
It did, the tail rotor blades changed out, which the number of the blades changed from 11 to 10, and it kind of changed the distinctive whine that the H-65 used to have.
Wow. Well, can you tell us about what was your first rescue mission like?
My very first rescue mission I completed was, my first assignment was flying out of Savannah, Georgia, and we were up off Myrtle Beach, and we were searching for a guy who's lost in a jet ski. And I still remember, because we landed at Myrtle Beach Airport at like 2:30 in the morning, a line of storms had come through, and so we ducked in there, we're getting fuel. And this is my first SAR case ever, and in the FBO there is Jeff Foxworthy. And he's like, what are you guys doing? We're like, oh, we're out looking for a guy in a jet ski. And he does this whole skit about a redneck on a jet ski with a flashlight in his mouth. And I was like
no,
right.
Jeff, this is serious.
Yeah. I was like, wow, this is a good introduction into aviation. I love it.
So, yeah.
But I had some really good rescues throughout my career. Most people in the Coast Guard end up doing quite a few offshore rescues as well. You think, to your point, Tom, maybe, you know, people's worst day, there's something going wrong with the boat or medically with them. And, you know, it's, they're pretty far out, or it'll take too much time for any other resource to get there and get them to the help that they need.
Here's a question. This is maybe a little bit of a PSA here on the Green Dot, having done some sailing myself, and certainly we have a lot of people who fly who listen to this. What could you tell people helps the most when you're looking for somebody, in a situation like that? What kind of equipment or things can they do to be found better?
Sure. First thing is file a float plan, we call it. You know, let people know where you're going and, you know, where you're going to be and when you're going to come back. I've been out there searching for a lot of people, and they wound up being in port already, but they didn't tell people, right? So, yeah. When I say flying, I mean like in tropical storms, hurricane type conditions, looking for people that were already ashore, you know. So definitely file that float plan. We all love our cell phones, but you can't rely on that offshore. You really need a radio. It's good to have an emergency beacon as well in case you do get in trouble. We have equipment, DF equipment on the helicopter. We can find you pretty easy. And at night, we fly on night vision goggles. So any light out there, you got to imagine it's a sea of blackness, you know, so any light out there instantly, it like lights up like the Statue of Liberty. It's easy to find you then.
Awesome. Good advice.
Is there a certain rescue that stands out for you over the years?
The several rescues. I think tonight I'll talk about Katrina and Rita as well. But in New Orleans, I did one where we went out in the fog and it was really rough, and filed two flight plans, one going out, one coming back. And we wound up, shooting, an approach through the clouds. We call it a catch, but approach through the clouds, broke out low, started hoisting to a fishing boat. A gentleman had got his arm caught in the winch. And while hoisting to the fishing boat, it went back into the fog. And so hoisting to the back of the boat, and I can't even see the bow of the boat anymore, but we pulled the gentleman up, we got our rescue swimmer back, and then really kind of low on fuel, but this is sometimes you got to take one step back to go two steps forward. We had to go further offshore to an oil platform, and we had, reports that it was clear of the fog, and we were counting on those reports to be accurate, and they were, and so we were able to land there, get fuel, and then come back, shoot an ILS down to minimums, and then scud run over to a hospital to drop off the patient. So I would say that was like, really, really busy, good SAR case.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very complex case. Yeah. And it's funny because that's not the first story that we've heard of something like that. I mean, having to leave the search area, go get fuel in some, kind of ersatz way, and then right back in it. Yeah.
I got to ask, what's it like carrying a rescue swimmer, and how do you, I guess, what's the procedure for dispatching your rescue swimmer into the water? Is there something you have to do in the aircraft control-wise?
Well, obviously we, four heads are better than one. So you have two pilots, a flight mechanic and a rescue swimmer, and you kind of game plan together. Ultimately the pilot in command is in charge of the mission, but yeah, you would never, deploy the swimmer if they weren't comfortable that, that this rescue was within their capabilities. And I just have to say our swimmers are just amazing. they train really, really hard, and, they're willing to sacrifice and put it all out there. They'll think about jumping out of a perfectly safe helicopter into 20-foot seas into a storm. And I give them credit too, because they always keep cool and calm, and they try to like really help survivors stay good. I was telling Chris about a story about how they came upon a raft full of survivors one time, and they opened the raft door and they said, "Hey, anyone order a pizza?" so, they do try to, you know, bring a little levity and to help out and make people, you know, realize, hey, we're here now, we got you, and you're going to be okay.
Wow. Yeah. So we talk about these rescue operations where, yeah, you're dropping a swimmer into 20-foot seas, and of course, there's a lot of wind that creates a 20-foot sea. And a lot of what we hear about is just how you're able to hold it in, you know, you and all the other rescue pilots are able to hold it in the hover so well in these extreme conditions. Do you practice for that? I mean, do you just go up on a 20-knot day and just practice your hovers, or how do you do that?
Yeah, we have a saying, you know, aggressive training saves lives, and yeah. I really believe that. My last assignment was San Francisco, and we would practice vertical surface rescues, cliff rescues. And yeah, we'd go out there and practice during the day. And then to your point, Tom, you know, at night we'll go practice, you know, hoisting to vessels and, you know, some pretty good chop as well, just to get used to how the pitching and rolling will affect you. And when you're flying the helicopter, you're really trying to be a stable platform, not necessarily to follow the pitching and rolling of the vessel to make it easy for the flight mechanic to control the hoist, to be able to control the basket or the litter or even, you know, the rescue swimmer at the end of the hook.
So I've got to ask a two-part question about being out on a cutter. One, is it difficult to land on the back of one of those things?
Absolutely it is. especially if it's, you know, certain limits, right? If it's beyond limits, we won't go. But, you know, having said that, it's I've been right at limits a couple of times. And you got to imagine it's like a postage stamp, and you're trying to land on it. And the clearance was about 10 feet of rotor blade clearance from the hangar to being in the circle. So you do not have, you know, that large of a margin at all when you're coming in. So it takes some skill. It takes some practice. We do have a whole syllabus that we put people through. And then, you know, when you do go out, you'll go out with an instructor pilot, and they'll teach you. And then when you do your first deployment, you know, you're going to go out with a more experienced pilot. And then eventually you'll build up your experience and you'll help train the next generation.
Wow. And is there any special considerations that you have to take into account on the aircraft with exposure to, like, this, you know, salt water and stuff like that when you're on the boat?
So absolutely. So we'd wash the helicopter every day and keep it clean. And corrosion, you know, is our enemy. We were always fighting corrosion. One of my jobs in the Coast Guard was I was an aeronautical designated engineering officer in the Coast Guard. So I was in charge of maintenance and the mechanics for the helicopters. Frankly, I loved it. Loved working with the hangar deck. I think it's like the best job in the Coast Guard. But we always fight in corrosion. As a matter of fact, the Coast Guard every 4 years will bring each helicopter in. They'll strip it down, take everything apart, fix all the corrosion, and then build it back up again. And while they're building it up, that's the times when we would do like those upgrades, like when you put the 65 from Alpha to Bravo to Charlie, Delta, Echo. You do it when it's going through that depot level maintenance.
I actually have to on Chris's line of questions. I had another one on being deployed to a cutter. You know, when we hear about naval aviators, we always think about the aircraft carrier. You know, basically a ship that exists to support naval aviators, an entire battle group that exists to support naval aviators. And I always wonder what life is like on a smaller vessel, you know, like a cutter, where you are kind of more integrated into a vessel that has many other purposes and systems. You're one of the systems on the ship. What is that like?
No, great question, Tom. Yeah, absolutely. You're one of the departments, you know, so it's like an aviation department, aboard the ship. You know, some people call it aviation detachment, but I didn't like that. I think you're really more part of the ship's crew and you fit in that way. And so you're just one of the few, but the cutters, to your point, are multi-mission. They have an awful lot to do. I just think law enforcement or helping out with migrants. You know, you just look at what was happening with Haiti, right? And Coast Guard cutters are out there picking up people who are trying to make it to the U.S. and they're in anything that can float, and they're overcrowded, and it's a really dangerous situation. It can quickly go from migrant interdiction to search and rescue, right? Mm-hmm. So I give the cutter folks a lot of credit. You know, they're really multi-mission like that, and so you know, as aviation department on the ship, you're part of that. So you can help out with the migrants. And then if it becomes a search and rescue case, you're switching and you're helping out with that as well.
I guess also, you mentioned the law enforcement side of that. Do you have any good stories from the law enforcement side of what you did?
So nowadays we have a squadron of armed helicopters, and they go out, and these marksmen are incredible. They'll shoot out engines on go-fast vessels that are carrying drugs and supporting all these cartels and doing really bad things. These marksmen are incredible, and they'll go out and do that. But back early on in my flying career, before we had that squadron, I stopped a go-fast vessel, and I was really proud of that. And we came right beside them and got them to stop, and we were able to interdict the drugs and the people. And that was a really good law enforcement day for me. When I look back on my career, it was great.
That's awesome.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like flying rescue operations in Katrina?
Yeah, absolutely. First, I was stationed in New Orleans during the time. So I had, at this point, been flying Coast Guard missions for about 7 years. So I was pretty proficient as an aviator, especially as a Coast Guard aviator. I was also the engineering officer, so in charge of the maintenance and logistics side of the house for the aviation as well. And, Katrina was in... like nothing I think I've been seen before. You had 80% of a major U.S. city underwater, tens of thousands of people in trouble, rooftops, from their balconies, on submerged cars, just all calling for help and asking for help. And I just give the Coast Guard men and women so much credit. Within 12 hours making landfall, we had a quarter of our rotary wing fleet already on scene, doing missions to save folks, and over a period of 7 days, hoisted or rescued by helicopter over 7,100 people in 7 days. It's just pretty remarkable. I don't think people quite realize just how big of a feat that was, and did it all too, I'll say, without injuring or hurting one person, without any mishaps. Wow. It's just incredible.
Wow.
And of all the rescue operations that took place during Katrina, how much would you say was the rotary wing aspect of it? I'd imagine it was quite a lot.
In total, the Coast Guard rescued over 33,000 people. Wow. During Katrina, fair amount by small boats as well. So you got to give credit to those folks.
Sure.
They went out in the water, and it was disgusting and terrible, full of just junk and everything else floating. And, they went door to door and rescued people as well. But I really like to talk about the aviation side of the house, because that was what I was a part of and witnessed firsthand and got to see. And, we don't train for urban search and rescue. And at that point, we never had. And so a lot of the techniques and, what would happen and, what we learned during Katrina was just on the spot.
Yeah, so you're talking about how you typically do marine rescue with the rescue swimmer and the engineer. Were you doing stuff kind of like fire department rescue, where you're bringing in axes and demolition equipment to be able to cut into roofs and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a first day. A swimmer went out and tried to get somebody out of the attic, and we have a little axe in the helo.
Yeah,
but to your point, Tom, it wasn't sharp or anything. Yeah. It was like dull. It was like trying to take a hammer and cut through the roof. It just didn't work. But they saw a fire truck down there, so they went and landed in the field next to the fire truck, grabbed the axe. Swimmer went back up, hacked a hole and did the rescue, but word quickly got out that, hey, we need axes. And I give folks in Mobile, Alabama credit at the time, because they went, bought out every axe out of every hardware store that they could get their hands on. And next thing you know, every helo had an axe in it, and we're hacking away and trying to rescue people that you could get to, so.
Chris, I think that's one thing we've heard from so many of our rotary wing guests is just the improvisation that they've had to do. We had the Air Florida pilot, mm-hmm. Who was basically rescuing people with pool toys.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody in traffic had a pool toy and tied it to the line, and the line was the rotor tail tie down. So when you watch that rescue back on YouTube, that's he's using a tail or a main rotor tie down and a pool toy to rescue people. I mean, just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and your rescues are no less amazing. Is there one rescue during Katrina that you kind of think of from time to time that?
That there is some I absolutely think of. There's one where we the swimmer hacked a hole in the roof and in the ceiling, and we hoisted a lady right from her bed up through the roof through the ceiling. She weighed about 400 pounds, and she had just had open heart surgery and had gotten infected. And we brought her to the hospital in New Orleans. But at that time, the hospital wasn't accepting patients, and they, they were overwhelmed as well. But, feel bad to this day, but there was nowhere else to really take this lady. So we did take her to the hospital, and they did take care of her, but you got to imagine the hospitals were just all infrastructure, communications, transportation. They were all just overwhelmed.
Yeah,
absolutely. What was the? Can you tell us a little bit about what the traffic was like? The air traffic in the area. I mean, it had to just be a sea of helicopters out there.
Yeah, it was absolutely a sea of helicopters. In the beginning, I flew the first helicopter in afterwards. So I was telling Chris this. It was silent, like no approach. Nobody, and that is almost as eerie as anything out there. I could go land at New Orleans International, which is Class Bravo airspace, and not really have to talk to anybody. It's kind of strange when you think about it. But then as the days progressed, and I talked about how we had a quarter of the Coast Guard Hilo fleet there within 12 hours, and then that grew to about 50% of our Hilo fleet in the coming days. And then other agencies, Navy helicopters, started coming in as well. So I can remember, by Thursday, Friday of that week, you'd be hovering over the city of New Orleans. And what happened, too, was the surrounding areas had, all the rescues had been done already. So now everyone's really concentrated on downtown New Orleans. And I can literally remember being in a hover and counting like no less than 9 or 10 helicopters just in front of me, like what I could see. Doing rescues as well.
Wow. Any other agencies that were involved other than the Coast Guard, or like local medevac involved, things like that?
The Navy was involved for sure. I know the Army was, that they had sent helicopters as well. The DOD also sent, non-hoist equipped helicopters. And really, that made a huge difference, because then we were able to set up staging areas, landing zones where... The 65, love it, but it is a little underpowered, can only fit so many survivors at a time. So you could do short little hops with the 65, drop people off at a landing zone or a site where we could put food and water for them. And then the larger DOD helicopters could come in, pick them up, and take them to like international and other places where they could be bussed out.
That's wild. Yeah, we had a tie to it where I used to work, because all of our training was done by Metro Aviation over at Shreveport. I mean, so it wasn't too far away, but that's and then there was a big finishing assembly there for Eurocopter. I don't know if it's still there or not, but it was at the time. But man, that's something else. Did you guys fly all night, or what would you do?
24/7 operations. We would try to get a little crew rest if we could, but it mostly consists of just an hour or two sleep a night for the first week. We tried to bring in backup crews, and this is just a good example. We had set our priorities before the hurricane came, and our folks knew that they probably would not be able to get back in through New Orleans, but they made their way to Mobile and Houston, that we could get them back in. And so we were able to get relief crews in, and over time would get people a break. I think I went about 7 straight days and then finally got relieved and was able to go. I was wondering where I had one daughter. She was like 6 years old, and my wife, and I was like, I kind of wonder where they're at, And, was able to go. I had 24 hours off, was able to go meet them and, give them a hug. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that has to be scary when you're rescuing in the community that you live in. You know, I mean,
Chris, I think that's a great point. So, you know, as Coasties, I say we really get involved in the community that we're a part of. My wife's a teacher, so she, you know, taught at a school, and you know, I've always coached wherever I've been at. So you really get to know people. And we had 28% of our folks that lived in the New Orleans area. They lost, you know, all of their stuff. So you got to imagine that not only are they doing rescues, but they're helping out, picking up their neighbors, but it's over their own house that where they lost, you know, all their belongings and, you know, what belonged to them, really important stuff. Afterwards, we got together as a group and we would form work parties and we would go and help fix up each other's houses. And it was good. I got up there and they gave me a nail gun one time and I helped fix the guy's roof. And so we tried to make a positive out of it.
Absolutely. You know, they always talk about like the, you know, with firefighters, there's like a firehouse mentality, a brotherhood. Does that exist, you think, in the Coast Guard and in the aviation units?
Absolutely. It sure does. As a matter of fact, I would say we have a bond that's unbreakable with the Katrina folks. We did a 10-year reunion and I think we had all but one pilot, I think, make it back. And that's like 90% of the unit come back. It was pretty remarkable.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, you also you flew Hurricane Rita relief.
I'll tell you, if Katrina didn't happen, people would really remember Rita. I don't think they realized just how powerful a storm it was and the damage it did. It came within 4 weeks of Katrina, and it hit Louisiana as well, but the more western side, like towards Lake Charles. And I have to say, the flying I did in Rita in some ways was way harder than what I did in Katrina. I'll say that. We flew through a little bit more intense bands at that time. It was, very challenging rescues in Rita as well. And that one there, what I remember most was the police had the 911 calls from the night before. So they were able to pinpoint and tell us where the, the calls had come in from. But we didn't, you're flying in a new town. So, someone says to you, oh, it's at 12 Main Street. You don't know where that is, right? So we would take, a local fireman or a policeman on board and they could help vector us into the house that we would need to go do the rescue. So.
That is interesting. You know, probably the police aviation probably is a little bit better equipped to pinpoint an address versus Coast Guard.
Yeah, so that was something I think came out of Katrina was we quickly figured out how to do it.
Yeah,
because we had to, and yeah. I think now we have the software will tell us what it is, but it's but that was something we hadn't experienced before. You know, we're maritime, right?
So, sure.
Yeah. Just different doing urban search and rescues.
Sure. Yeah.
What are your basically like the weather minimums that you would or wouldn't go out? I mean, you guys are, the Coast Guard is famous for going out in just horrible weather and these huge rescues. And I always wondered, like, is there like on the EMS helicopters I was on, we had weather minimums that like if we couldn't take a mission, if the visibility or ceiling was too low. Does that even exist with you guys? Or if it does, it has to be pretty low.
It does exist. And, I've been retired for a little bit now, almost 2 years, but it's basically like a quarter mile. And even that's waiverable if you, but it is a discussion to be had. And then I was twice a CO of an air station and you'll put in your standing orders, when you want to be called or not, and to have that discussion if there is certain weather. So, yes, so we do look at it. We do talk about it. There is aircraft limitations as well. After Katrina and Rita, they did go back and add a section into the Dash 1 about not flying or being in weather greater than 55 knots. So they did establish a limit after that, which was probably good. So
I think that's significantly higher than most GA pilots' personal minimums. So you mentioned that you were CO of two air stations.
I did. I did a command at an 05 level of Los Angeles, and then I did command a 06 level up in San Francisco. So.
Could you speak a little bit to the kind of the structure of the Coast Guard air stations and what waters they cover?
Sure, absolutely. So we have about 24 air stations. They're spread all around the country. Think, you know, up and down the East Coast, the Gulf, and then the West Coast. We're also in Alaska and Kodiak and Sitka, Alaska, in Hawaii as well, at Barbers Point, and Barrincon, Puerto Rico. Some air stations are strictly just helicopter units. Others, the larger ones, are both helicopter and fixed wing. And there's maybe one that's just fixed wing, you know. But in general, you either have a hybrid or just a helicopter one. And you're kind of, you know, you have your area of responsibility. They each do what they will cover. And some of that, you know, depends on capability of the platform. Obviously, the 60 with its, it can take extended fuel tank, external fuel tank, so it can get extended range to go for more like 6 hours, right? The Dolphin's limited to more like 3 hours. So,
and then when a helicopter embarks on a cutter, it's usually it's drawn from like the local air station or something like that.
It's not from always the local air station. Okay. So the cutters are spread throughout the country as well. Mm-hmm. And we have Atlantic area and a Pacific area command, and they will, you know, they will task air stations to support, you know, so many days underway and so many deployments per year. So you kind of, you know, and so you can manage it and, you know, maybe get folks ready for that shipboard quals that I was talking about earlier. Yeah. You know, and you know when it's your turn to do deployments. I've done, you know, multiple deployments in my career on the back of cutters. So it doesn't always go with the local. It kind of will, you know, flip flop a little bit, and they'll task each air station then. So
got it. Oh, that's interesting.
You know, it's all relative, as you're talking about, you know, the Dolphin not having as long legs, but in the civilian EMS world, it had huge legs because you're talking about stuff like the EC-135, 145 that had like an hour and a half to hour 45, maybe 2 hours of fuel in the 145, depending on how you're equipped. So we used to laugh whenever, you know, the EC-135 would call off with, you know, three souls and an hour and a half of fuel. And then one of the Dolphins would chime in, leaving with four souls and, you know, 3 hours of fuel on board. You're just like, whoa, those guys could fly forever, you know.
It's always relative, right?
Like, yeah,
you know, the fixed wing pilots, you know, they'd be gone forever. And yeah, I used to always think the 60s, wow, 6 hours. I don't think my back could handle that, you know. But yeah, you just get, I think you get used to what you fly. I've obviously flew the 65 over, you know, the career. My whole career, so got very used to 2.5-3 hour sorties.
Wow! So you talked about, you know, the hoist, and that, you know, I think everybody has seen these amazing videos of the rescues from a helicopter with a hoist. But you were telling me that you can you tell me the parameters of where you think a pilot could be able to hold the basket?
To hold it, I think during the daytime, Coast Guard pilots will hold within probably a 2 foot. Basket, if you would, up or down or left or right. And if the conditions are good, you know, the wind is nice and everything, even better than that. But about 2 or 3 feet, I would say, Chris. At night, you know, it gets more challenging with the you know, how much the vessel's moving, how much the seas are, you know, what the winds are. That's why I will say, though, the Dolphin likes the wind. So, and we like the wind because it gives us more of a power margin. It actually helps out with the power. So in some ways, it makes it easier than when there's no wind conditions. But yeah, at night, you know, most helicopter pilots are going to keep it within 5 feet, I would say.
That's incredible. 5 feet on a, you know, a pitching deck or something out there that's wild. And you know, it's so important because if you're from the perspective of this person needing help, and you're stuck out there on that boat or wherever you are on a raft or something, that Dolphin's got to be about the most beautiful thing you've ever seen.
I would absolutely think so. Thankfully, I've never been on the other end, I guess.
I guess one last question, having seen a couple of presidential visits around this area, it typically is either an H-65 or an H-60 from the local Coast Guard station that provides a lot of the perimeter security. Just curious about that. That seems like something that Well, I don't know. Is it because of the law enforcement mission of the Coast Guard that they get tasked with that in certain areas?
That is a mission that we picked up during my time frame in the Coast Guard. As a matter of fact, when I was in 05, I think I was the first to be in charge of a detachment to do that for presidential security. It's rotary wing air intercept. So basically, if there's a slow moving target that's maybe too slow for the jets, we can go intercept and find out who it is and what they're doing there when they shouldn't be there. So
yeah, I just find that interesting with the Air National Guard typically doing the air sovereignty role and at least the fast moving air sovereignty role a little farther away. But oh well, I think it's just an interesting tidbit of just one of the many missions that you guys serve.
It is, and good point. I probably should have mentioned it earlier, Tom. I'm glad you brought it up. It's something that I think the Coast Guard does, and they do that mission set really well too. So
that's amazing.
So I know we're fighting the clock, but I have to ask one final question. And anybody that knows me, especially Tom and the friends listening, is I'm a movie nerd. All right, The Guardian. Let's hear it. Good or bad?
I loved it. How could I not love it? I think I told Chris before when I first started. A lot of people joined. They had watched Top Gun and joined, and then throughout my career, maybe feel a little older, but there was a lot of people that The Guardian definitely influenced, and they really loved it. And the other thing I told Chris about The Guardian was my parents watched it, and after they watched it, they're like, I don't know if we want you guys flying offshore like this anymore, So, but I will say there's definitely some Hollywood to it, but there's also some realistic too. We do go out and in some bad weather and do some really high risk missions.
Wow. Well, you're here as part of our speaker series. So when people are listening to this, just know that, he had been here. We do a speaker series. It's about every Thursday or every third Thursday of the month. We really get amazing storytellers like yourself here. So thank you for coming out and being a part of this. I've been having a blast. I'm literally looking forward to tonight. Just thank you for being out there, and thank you for the listeners for supporting it. Hope you guys can get a chance to come out and see some of our awesome speakers at the speaker series. But Tom, it looks like we're almost out of time here.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. Absolutely, Tom. I have to say that I can say very confidently that our Coast Guard is the envy of the world in terms of the rescue mission, the law enforcement mission, everything else that you do. It's incredible. We try to never get ourselves into too much trouble out there, but it's an incredible peace of mind to know that you're out there watching our backs. So thanks for all of that. It really is a critical service to the country. And we'll look forward to seeing you tonight. And absolutely, we always say it, check our schedule. We do the speaker series just about every month. Couple of exceptions for AirVenture and holidays, but do check that out. And Chris, do we record those sessions?
We do. Yep, yeah. We record them, and so you can watch them at a later date. But yeah.
Yeah, so definitely check EA's video page for that. But other than that, again, Tom, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for letting me come and tell the story of the Coast Guard men and women of aviation and what they do. Obviously, I'm totally biased. I just think they're awesome and incredible, and I look forward to tonight tell the story of Katrina a little bit. And I think it's a history that needs to be remembered, and no better place to tell it than at the EAA Museum. So.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for doing that. And then to all you listening, of course, as we always say, if you like what you're hearing, certainly leave us a review. If you have any feedback at all, feedback@eaa.org is the place to find us. And we'll see you next time when you are cleared to land on the green dot.